Thanks very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Good afternoon to you. We'll talk to Elise Glink a little bit later in the program about housing and the housing supply and how the number of houses on the market continues to shrink. That coming up, Ian Schur is an editor at CNET, and we'll kick around the big Google showcase from earlier this week as well. But we're going to start things out with student loans, your kids' student loans, or maybe yours. Pat Cutoletta is in the studio, Executive Director of Financial Advisor with Morgan Stanley here in Chicago. I almost got it, Pat. It was so close. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you.
Welcome to the Business Lunch.
Thank you.
All right. So everyone's going to give graduation speeches and about the future and changing the world and raising families. And really all you would say was figure out a way to pay off your student debt.
Well, the reality is that an awful lot of the students in that audience will have student debt. And it's an obligation. It's no less an obligation than a car payment or a mortgage. And so, yes, a lot of them will have to figure out how to pay for it.
I have a statistic that the average graduate this year will have $37,000 in student loan debt.
Right.
That's pretty amazing. Monthly payment would break down to about $350 a month.
At least.
And so, well, that's quite a thing to wake up to after the party, right? So people
right.
should be working on strategies now.
Absolutely.
What do you do?
Well, there are a number of things you can do, but I think the most important thing is to realize that it's a responsibility. The default rate on student debt is over twice the default rate on other consumer debt. And so clearly someone's not considering it an obligation.
Well, they used to let you get away with it, didn't they? I mean, back in the 80s and so, they weren't so tough.
Well, they don't today.
That's over.
It's that simple. So, I think you have to make it a part of your life. So if your rent is going to be X, and your car payment is going to be Y, and your entertainment budget is going to be Z, maybe Z has to be a little smaller to make sure that that student debt gets paid.
How much difference is there among different loans and loan programs? I mean, because I know with some, right, you don't have to start paying right away. You get a bit of a grace period.
Some of them, yes, there are some differences in repayment schedules. Some require that you start right away. Some require that you start right away, but you can start at a lower payment level, and then that ramps up to a higher level. Some give you a little bit of a hiatus, time to find a job
right.
and so forth. But again, we're not talking
time
4 or 5
years. Time to move to Mexico. Or...
Yeah, right.
When I was reading some of your advice, and I was kind of surprised that I thought if you signed onto a loan, you were going to have to kind of repay it the way the loan originator dictated, like here's how you have to pay it. But it seems as if sometimes you get a bit of a choice, or what are the choices?
Sometimes you have a couple of choices. So sometimes you can say, I don't want to start for X number of weeks or X number of months. I want time to get a job, but then I'm willing to start. Other times you'll say, I can start right away, but my salary should increase 2, 3, 4, 5, 7 years from now. So then it can ramp up. You have to talk with the lender.
And what is your advice? What's the best way to go? I mean, I would imagine just pay off as much as you can as quickly
Absolutely.
As you can.
Absolutely. Putting it off doesn't do any good.
Right. And so that might mean living with mom and dad a little longer?
It could mean living with mom and dad, or it could be not driving quite as nice a car as you'd like,
right.
or not quite as many nights out with the gals and the guys.
Well, here's a strategy. Live with mom and dad for a while, because that might prompt them to help you pay off some of that loan.
Well, some parents do a matching. As an incentive for the youngster to actually take the responsibility of paying, mom and dad might say, we'll match your payment 50 cents on the dollar.
Right.
Or we'll match it a dollar on the dollar. One thing we would counsel parents is don't think it's your loan, because it's not your debt. It's the child's
but
debt.
But I saw a statistic not too long ago about the number of older Americans who are saddled with student loan debt.
Oh, sure.
So those are parents, right, or grandparents who signed on to their kids' student loans.
Who co-signed.
So they do have some responsibility.
If they co-sign.
Right. Right. Which you would advise, I would imagine sometimes you don't have a choice.
Sometimes you don't have a choice. And some of those older Americans, by the way, are people who've gone back to school.
Yeah.
So it's not all parents or grandparents. It's in many cases, it's people who have changed careers, maybe had to change careers and had to go back and get some updated education.
So if you're 65 years old and you always wanted that English degree, remember, if you take out the loan, you still have to repay it.
That's exactly right.
All right, so we got the matching funds, which I like, but
uh-huh.
here we are at graduation season. What am I going to give Susie?
Gifting.
So tell me about gifting.
I heard the statistic this morning that over 50% of people who are going to give a graduation gift will give cash.
Right, I get
and
that.
And so, again, rather than taking that cash to buy a new iPad or a new phone, you might want to think very long and hard about using that gift to pay down your loans. So if the sooner you start, the better.
Right. So if you get the gift, if you're the receiver of this big hunk of cash, maybe put it toward your loan.
Right.
If you're giving the cash, is there a way to make sure it goes toward the loan?
I think you simply would have to delineate it. I am not positive, quite frankly, that you can make a direct payment.
Because that would be nice, wouldn't it, to really control your kids that way or your nephew.
Depends on whether you're into control.
Well, who isn't, Pat? Okay, another advice for grads, you say, you know, live within your means, factor mm-hmm. this in. But maybe it comes to graduation money or whatever. If you come upon some money, a bonus or whatever,
sure.
rather than soaking it up, what do you
Absolutely.
Do with it?
Absolutely. Then you just chunk it in toward the student loan.
Right.
Which, again, makes the balance smaller and means the whole thing gets paid off sooner.
I saw there were some numbers on credit and household credit debt this week come up. How are we doing in general when it comes to student loans? Are we paying off the loans better now than we did 10 or 15
No.
years ago? Worse,
No.
really.
Now, the delinquency rate in 2016, I believe, was around 11%. The most recent thing, I'm sorry, in 15 was around 11%. The most recent thing I saw for 2016 was way over 10%.
And why do you think that is?
So there's not much of a difference.
No. Why do you think that is?
I think some people don't think it's a true obligation.
Because
they can,
am I wrong?
You can skip out on something, you can skip out on it.
Wasn't it easier to skip out on it? Didn't a lot of people skip out on it in the 80s?
Well, I think so. I think that's part of the reason the delinquency rate is as high as it is.
Because mom and dad got away with it, or mom and dad don't realize or have it instilled in their kids that times have changed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Pat Cutoletta is the executive director of financial advisor of Morgan Stanley in Chicago. Thanks for coming by today.
Thank you very much.
And so there should be graduation cards, like to the graduate, use this money toward your student debt.
Great idea.
We'll see. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Steve Bertrand here on this Thursday afternoon, a beautiful day. I'm going to go home and fire up my chainsaw because I have about a 30-foot limb that fell down on the driveway right between two cars early this morning. So we'll see how that goes. But summertime is coming, and we'd like to talk about summer festivals, and we certainly will do that coming up. A little bit later in the program, we'll talk to Ian Schur. You know, he is a writer, editor at CNET.com, and Ian comes by to talk from time to time about what's going on in the world technology. And there just was a big Google show about what's next with Google. And apparently they're working on an Alexa camera, which we'll see how that goes. But there's this new piece of, I don't know if it's hardware or software, it's called Google Lens. And they say that that is going to have a dramatic impact on us and how we use our computers in the future. So we'll talk to Ian about that, just exactly what is Google Lens. I think he wants to kick around spyware and things such as that as well. And then later in the program, we'll talk to Elise Glink. Elise is from ThinkLink, as you know, and joins us most Thursday afternoons. And we'll talk about, the dearth, I guess, of stock when it comes to housing around the country and about how there are buyers there, but there aren't that many takers or houses to choose from when it comes to what's going on. But we're going to talk about summer festivals right now. And on a phone line with us is Amy Amder from Amder Productions. Amy, welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Well, thank you. It's nice to have lunch with you.
You bet. Would you pass the ketchup, will you please? A little bit of that?
I
know that
I want some more fries.
The mayor has called this the year of public art. And, you know, I live up in the northern suburbs, and it seems like on summer weekends, if we're, my wife and I are looking for something to do, we go north, south, east, or west and come upon an outdoor art festival. And lo and behold, most of them are put up by your company. Tell me a little bit about Amder Productions.
Well, Amder Productions is a company I founded 34 years ago. It's hard to believe it was that long ago. I was out of college. I finished at Northwestern. Was working with my dad, Steve Amder, and he and his partners were redeveloping downtown Highland Park. And I said to them, how are we going to kick this project off? What are we going to do to bring people into downtown Highland Park? And they all looked at me and they said, you handle it. So I came up with a summer's worth of activities, music at the plaza, a taste of Port Clinton, and then I came up with the idea of an art festival to bring people and kind of get them to walk around the twists and turns of the project.
And that is the Port Clinton Art Fair, right?
That's right. That was 34 years ago.
And that usually marks the hottest weekend of the summer, I think.
sometimes, but I remember a few cold ones too.
Well, you know, that strikes me with a business like yours. I mean, the lot depends on what you do, and then you can have the greatest art, the greatest food trucks or whatever lined up, and then you get lousy weather. I mean, there's some things you just can't control.
Right. And at that point, we just have to let go and just say whatever happens, happens. What? So we try to plan for everything. But I always say the one thing we can't plan for is the weather.
Tell me about lining up the artists, because I do go to several of your events every year. And, you know, I think sometimes I'll see some at more than one art fair. But it seems as if you do a pretty good job of mixing it up. Is there that big of a pool of artists in the Midwest that you can choose from? Or are there artists that go wanting for spots?
Well, that's an excellent question. In fact, we do a call for artists in October and November. So right when the season's winding down, we're working on the next year already. We do a national call for artists. And in fact, we have artists from coast to coast, often from, you know, outside of the U.S. as well, coming in, a lot of artists from Canada, at times South America, Europe, coming in for our festival. So there are a lot of artists out there, and you know, we're happy to have them. So we do a call for artists, and then artists have to apply. They have to actually be selected and invited to come into our shows.
Yeah, you know,
and each show is separate. So that's why there should be variation, because you have to apply to Port Clinton or you apply to Botanic Garden, you know, specifically. So it does create a different group of artists at the shows.
I feel for those artists because, you know, I'm one of those guys who walks in, shows great attention, and then walks out. And, you know, there they are. I would imagine a pretty good chunk of their income, well, you tell me, comes from shows like this, because, you know, this is where they're getting their art, their product out to people. They probably more than anyone need good weather and good crowds.
Well, you know, the weather, there's a wide range of acceptable weather. And I have to tell you, you know, not that I like to say the four-letter word starting with an R, which, you know, is when water comes down from the sky.
Yeah.
But that word, even in situations, if it's not too terrible, artists still sell because people want to be in the booth and not in the weather.
Nice.
But, you know, generally we're working with artists who are full-time artists, and they are making their living doing this kind of gypsy thing where they go from city to city and from show to show.
Right.
And the good ones are good small business owners, and they are managing their small business and marketing themselves. And maybe they've attended some of the boot camps that I've done where we talk about sales and presentation. Because, you know, there is a certain professionalism and maybe more sophistication than the public may know when it comes down to what they're seeing at the show.
You know,
and
Amy,
a good artist. Pardon me?
I'm sorry. I've got to run. I've got a lot more questions for you. Maybe you can come by another time. Let me just ask you this. Can you see the overall economic condition of the area based on sales at your art fairs? Is there a correlation?
I can. I think it's pretty much there is a direct correlation. When things are better in the country, we see higher sales. And right now, we are seeing higher sales. We're seeing people buying art for their homes, for their offices, wanting to kind of really surround themselves with things that make them feel good. And that's what we're seeing right now.
Amy,
we're happy about it.
Amy Emder, the owner of Emder Productions. I'll see you this summer.
I look forward to it. Thanks so much.
You bet. Thank you very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. All right, it's Thursday. Most Thursdays, Ian Schur stops by, executive editor of news at CNET. And, well, Ian, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Hi, how are you doing?
That's quite a title, executive editor of news. What's next for you? Just to own the thing, or what's going on with that?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's the stepping stone to eventually being you know, the person who runs the entire world.
So you guys,
I'm a step below. My boss is still in charge, but one day I'll take over, and then you'll just be reporting to me, Steve.
Who says I'm not right now, Ian? all right, so, you know, I don't want to call you guys. You know, the people at CNET are great. They explain things for me. I wouldn't say they get a little geeked out from time to time, but they do. And so what's this big Google show that you guys are writing about?
Yeah, so this is geeky. Okay, I'll totally own that.
Thank you.
So Google, every year, Google, and by the way, Apple and Microsoft, all these people have big developer conferences, right? The people who make all the apps and programs that you use on your computer, They basically pulled them all together in a space, either in Seattle or San Francisco, or in this case, down in Mountain View near Google's headquarters, and basically have a rah-rah, let's talk about how awesome we are, and here's some new features we're working on. So Google, this year, talked a lot about actually just making the stuff they already make better. And so it was really interesting to see just kind of how much further down they're trying to make this whole idea of the computers that the services that they offer, the calendar, all this stuff, basically integrated into your life as much as they can.
What is Google Lens? Because I'm reading hearing quite a little about that.
Yeah. So, you know, Snapchat, for example, right?
Where right, right.
You can make it so that you like vomit rainbows and stuff like that. So the idea with Google Lens is to actually take that technology, which is called augmented reality, where they lay over computer images on the real world, and make it useful. Right. So not that vomiting rainbows is not useful, but
don't knock it till you try it, Ian.
So, for example, it's going to be able to do stuff like if you pull up the app, it's through the Google Assistant, which runs on Android phones, anything that's not an iPhone. It'll be able to tell you, like, for example, it'll turn on the camera. It'll tell you what plant you're looking at. So if you're on a hike and you just brushed up against something, you're like, oh, my gosh, is this going to leave a rash? You can just do that and it'll tell you right there. You can also use it to, for example, if you're in the middle of a street and you want to see what the restaurants are nearby and what they're, you know, how good they are, you just pull it up and it'll actually show you the ratings right above the restaurants in the real world. So they're trying to do it and may make it much more helpful. And we'll see whether or not it actually is, but it's a nifty idea.
And what's the other thing, too? It allows you to sign on to Wi-Fi much more easily than typical, or what was that part?
Exactly. So this is the other thing is they want to make it super easy to do smart things with it. So, for example, I don't know if you've ever done this. I've had to climb underneath someone's desk and look at the back of the modem where the password is and all that. So now if you do that, again, with an Android phone, not an iPhone, and you pull up the camera through the Google Lens thing, it'll actually say, hey, this is a Google, this is a Wi-Fi password. Do you want us to just automatically connect you? And it'll do it. And so they're trying to do smart things. The same thing will happen, by the way, if you are looking at a restaurant. Let's say you're in a Chinese restaurant or a Japanese restaurant, and everything's in, you know, not English, and you pull up the thing, it'll actually translate the text in real time and show you through the camera what it is in English. So all that type of nifty stuff.
And all of this is in an effort to get people to stop buying iPhones and to start buying Android phones again.
Well, there's a part of that. Definitely Google would like it if you didn't buy an iPhone. But they are actually bringing some of these features to the iPhone, so they're not keeping the iPhone users out entirely. But they do want to have you use Google services, right? Because the more you use Google, the more information they're able to suck up about you and then use to target ads at you, right? And they make more money that way. So the way Google sees it is whether or not you're an iPhone user or an Android user or whatever – as long as you're using Google software and their services, they win.
Right? I guess that makes sense, right? And so talk about sucking up information. That's why they're offering this alternative to Venmo as well. Talk about useful information, try to figure out what I buy from people, and then market to me that way. Tell me about their competition with Venmo.
Yeah, so what they're going to do, for example, is that they already have an Android Pay thing, which sounds a lot like Apple Pay because they're basically the same. But now, again, using this Google Assistant software that they have, which is supposed to be your digital assistant, you could do stuff like order if you want to do order takeout, for example. All you have to do is say to it, hey, I'd like to order takeout from X restaurant. And it'll immediately say, okay, what do you want? And you talk to it. You tell them what you want from the menu. And then it'll say, okay, and do you want to check out? And you can pay with your phone. And all that stuff becomes very simple. Right. And for them, it's really beneficial because, again, they're sucking up all this information about you. By the way, Apple is trying to do this a little bit.
Yeah.
Microsoft is trying to do this a little bit. Facebook is trying to do this a little bit. Everyone is trying to get to that nirvana of being the digital assistant you live with. Right. And basically making their technology your friend. And if they do, then they win. They get all this data on it.
Well, right? who's winning now?
Nobody. There's not a clear winner. And that is why they're all just busting it, trying to become the winner. You know, right now, everyone's kind of staked out their own ground. Apple, for example, has gotten really good at being basically ubiquitous. If I go, I'm paying for stuff at Walgreens with it. I'm able to go all sorts of other places and pay with it. They have really nailed that. It even works in some taxis, at least in San Francisco and New York. If you look at Google, they're trying to make it so that they work with as many websites as possible, right? And they just like I mentioned, the ordering systems and all of that.
Right.
And then Facebook is trying to make it so that they own the relationship part of it, right? That, you know, I already liked Gap's page. So Gap can then send me, hey, we saw you bought this T-shirt 6 months ago. We have a new style. Would you like to get it, right? So all these types of things, they're kind of sticking out their own ground, thinking, okay, how do we do this a little differently and get people to use it? Because, you know, that way, hopefully, they can win. And if they don't, at least they've staked out their own ground and they're not competing as much.
That is Ian Schur, the executive editor of News at CNET. Ian, great to talk to you again.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Steve Alexander. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGNR. You're in the car right now with your realtor, maybe out trying to find a house. You're trying to find a house, having a hard time finding somewhere to stop. Apparently, the inventory is low and it keeps getting lower. Elise Glink from thinkglink.com is on a phone line. Elise, welcome back to the Business Lunch.
Thanks, Steve. Nice to be here.
All right, tell me about that. I know I've got neighbors who've had their house for sale for a long time. They can't move it, but I hear from others that the inventory is just not there and homes are moving at a record pace.
Yeah, it's really interesting what's going on. There are some in Chicago, which is admittedly a little bit of a different market than most of the other places around the country. So let's talk nationally for the moment. What's going on here is that really the number of homes that are available for sale is pretty much the lowest it's been in a very long time. And we're seeing a contraction of the number of new homes going on the market each month, and that's been going on for 19 or 20 straight months. So Glenn Kelman, who's CEO of Seattle-based Redfin, which is a real estate firm that monitors about 80 metropolitan areas, including Chicago, is starting to talk about how the few number of homes and the shrinking number of homes in the market are actually limiting their business. Realtors are starting to feel it.
I'm worried about him. He said in the article that he's freaking out. We don't want him to freak out.
We don't. He is a little excitable anyway, just as but many CEOs who are nervous about their business can be. But what you're starting to see for the very first time is sales volumes start to get limited by this inventory crunch. And when you think about it, I've talked to you a couple of times, and I've talked with Steve Cochran on his show a couple of times about this. There is definitely a shift, a new dynamic in housing. Kelman refers to it as landlord nation.
I love this.
Because everybody's renting out everything.
I love this. Okay, so, you know, Airbnb is very popular and things like that. And so the idea is that people who maybe are buying a new house are holding on to their own house, old house, and renting it. I mean, rentals, I think, went up during the housing crisis and all of that. So the number of homes that would have normally gone on the market just aren't. People are keeping them. They're renting them. And because of that, the realtors are suffering a little bit.
They are. It's interesting because they're keeping it. People who refinanced into these historic low interest rates, you know, if you're in your primary residence, it's probably cheaper for you to stay there, even though it's a bigger house and you've got other costs, than to move to somewhere else because prices have been rising and interest rates have gone up a tad. So you're keeping the house you're in. Now you want to move, and you're realizing that you can actually, because rents have gone up dramatically,
right,
you can get so much money when you rent your house that it would be silly to give up that asset when what would you do with the cash anyway? It's not earning anything in the bank.
So is it a good time to be a realtor? I mean, here's what I'm picturing. I'm picturing a fisherman standing next to a pond and looking at all these fish, but she doesn't have a pole. I mean, right? The market is hot, but they don't have anything to sell.
Yeah, I think that that's pretty much how it is. It would be...
I'm sure no one else put it that way. I hope not anyway.
Not that I have heard, but it's actually an apt metaphor, right? Because what you're looking at is technology that has been giving people who own property, you know, 25 years after the promise was made, the internet's going to make it easier for you to buy or sell a house. What it actually has done is made it a whole lot easier for you to rent your property. And you have a whole lot of people who now want to be renters instead of buyers. And so this is why we're, you know, people like me and people like Kelman are talking about this being a new dynamic in housing, because the millennials who have all come of age, who are now maybe at the oldest level or 35 or 37, 10 years ago they were 25 or 27, and the youngest part of the millennials were still at home, not even in college yet, watching their parents suffer through the Great Recession.
Right.
And they were like, oh, why would I want to buy a house? It's so permanent. It's so scary. And so you're still seeing an overhang, which is interesting.
And so that's the big picture nationally. When you get a little bit closer to home, we tend to have lagged behind nationally, right? So if we're seeing that homes are selling in an average of 40 days or so, that's not necessarily the case in the Chicago area.
No, it isn't. And there are different pockets in different areas that you think would be going faster than they are. We've talked a couple of times on your show about the vast number of condos that are coming online this year. That's in downtown Chicago primarily. It's starting to slow that market a little bit. We're also seeing a lot of homes in Chicago that are still underwater with their mortgages, so they're worth less than the mortgage amount. Those houses have not sold very quickly either, even to investors. And then finally, in Chicago, which is a little bit different from elsewhere, you're seeing the decondoization. This is a made-up word entirely, but you have investors who are buying up condo buildings that aren't selling, where the condos aren't selling, and they're turning them all back into rentals.
Interesting. So that's interesting because I've talked to others who talked about or discussed people who bought apartments, kept them as apartments for a while until the housing market got hotter, and then they're going to convert them to condos.
Right. And on a small level, that's what's going on. But there are some investors that are actually, you know, they're taking anywhere from 50 to 200 condo units off the market at a single one fell swoop by turning those buildings back into rentals or back into rentals, if that's what they once were. And then the last thing I'll point out is that homes in higher price ranges are taking much, much, much longer to sell. And so you may see a house for over $1 million or $1.5 million, anywhere up to maybe $3 or $4 million, and that might take more than a year to sell.
All right, so what we're hearing today is everyone needs to go and hug a realtor.
Sure, why not? My mother will thank you.
Elise, great to talk to you again. I appreciate it.
You too, Steve.